Well, Paul, we can't put this off anymore. These mailbags have stacked up on us, and if we don't take care of them now, it's just going to get completely out of control.
Okay, is it purge week? Do I have to put on my gas mask and muck boots?
Yeah, it's purge week at the diecast for mailbags, the great mailbag purge. You know what? You want to read the first one?
Sure. Dear diecast, have you played the newest... Dear diecast, have you played the newest Borderlands 2 DLC? And if so, what are your thoughts on it? Well, we're on the subject. Hey, wait a minute. This is two questions. While you're on the subject, have you played Ultimate Vault Hunter mode? And if so, what do you think of the huge difficulty spike? Okay, so I guess it's like, what about Borderlands 2 DLC?
Yeah.
Sincerely, Grimoire.
All right, I just blew through that. Okay, I wanted to see the DLC, but I've got a lot on my plate this week. So the DLC is designed for context, for those of you who don't follow this. Borderlands 2 is a game from 2012. It got a bunch of DLC back in the day. It was all fantastic, but it's done getting DLC. The game is 7 years old. But just before the release of, or at the time of the announcement of Borderlands 3, they announced, hey, we're going to have a little more Borderlands 2 DLC. And I got it for free, and I don't know if everybody got it for free or how that worked. But I just got it, logged in, and I wanted to see the content, but I didn't have time to play through it properly. So you're supposed to play through it after you just completed the main game. Like level 30 to 40 is, I think, the level range intended.
Mm-hmm.
And I brought in my level 60 character and just powered through it with everybody dying in one shot. And I'm so glad the game lets you do that. That is just so nice.
You splashed through the game.
Right. Just run through and you get a bullet and you get a bullet and you get a bullet and everybody gets a bullet. And it's, you know, I plowed through it real quick. And I think it gives us I really like that they did this, not only so it connects story-wise. You know, they've written a bunch of story, and they wanted to connect the two games. Well, here's how things got however they are at the beginning of Borderlands 3. This DLC will bridge that gap. So that's nice that they did that. But it also tells us, it also gives us a snapshot of, like, how are they doing with this now that they've probably changed a lot of person. I mean, it's been 7 years. The main writer
turned over their entire writing staff, probably three quarters of their design staff.
Right. So do they still have it, or is this going to feel kind of weird? Is it going to feel like a weird shift? Like, oh, this doesn't feel like Borderlands anymore. Well, it feels like more Borderlands. It's not as quite as clever as the best parts of Borderlands 2, but, you know, it's on par with the average parts of Borderlands 2. It doesn't have those high peaks.
Most of Borderlands 2 isn't as good as the best parts of Borderlands 2.
Exactly. And this DLC just sort of maintains that sort of lighthearted, nothing's laugh out loud fun. I think I giggled once in the whole thing. But, you know, that's fine. That's fine. It maintained the tone. It didn't feel all weird. It didn't feel off. Or like somebody didn't know how to write these characters. So whoever is writing the game now is doing the job.
Not trying too hard, but also not reaching too far.
Right. And as for Ultimate Vault Hunter mode, the editor of this show, Isaac, has taken almost every character in the game to max level. Which means, okay, there are three difficulty levels. You beat the game once on normal mode. Then you take that same character and you start the game over in true Vault Hunter mode. And you play all the way to the end. And then you start over again in ultimate Vault Hunter mode. And, you know, the numbers keep going up and you keep gaining levels. And then at the end of your third playthrough, you just grind the final bosses until you hit the level cap. That's how it works.
Wow.
Yeah, Isaac has maxed out all the characters, I think, except Gage, which that's a huge investment of time. I think he's logged over 1,000 hours in the game. I have gotten one character into Ultimate Vault Hunter mode, and just the very beginning of the game, and I was like, nope, this is super boring for me, because the each difficulty level is a progressive, everything becomes more bullet spongy. You're a little more fragile, and they are a lot more damage absorby. So you just like to bring down one guy takes this huge and like 10 seconds of just shooting this guy in the head over and over and over again. Super boring for me. So what I've done is I've leveled all the characters through normal mode twice. Like, I have two of every character at level 40 just because I like playing through the content. I like hearing the jokes, but I do not like that long grind at the end of the game.
Not even for the Chivos, huh?
Not even for the cheap. No, I think that's why I went into Ultimate Vault Hunter mode is, oh, I could get some Chivos for, and then I was like, no, I do not want any Chivo this badly. This is really boring.
I have better things to do with my life.
Have you played any of these like Diablo, Titan Quest, Borderlands 2 kind of games?
No, I never really got into them. Mostly because I don't have time for it either. Like, I've been in school or working or had a family since I was born.
Right, like I kind of assumed everybody in the world got addicted to Diablo 2, around the turn of the millennium there, like around 98
Right.
is I think when it came out. And I just figured like the world stopped for a couple years while everybody played Diablo 2, but apparently there were a few people like you who were not infected.
Apparently my blood can cure people, and you're gonna have to take me apart at some point.
All right. We'll kickstart that.
Good. Good.
All right, next email. Dear Diecast, I finished Nier Automata a couple months ago and I've been thinking about it a lot since then because, oh boy, the story is a mess. Not bad, mind you, but definitely a mess. And the fascinating kind of mess at that. And I really, really want to see you analyze it. So I was wondering, you got a new computer recently, right? Have you tried Nier on it to see if it still crashes? I've read that the game tends to not do well with 7000 series. Okay. So failing that, you have a PS4, right? Can anyone who's interested gift you a copy? And they either didn't put a signature or I accidentally didn't copy the signature. I am sorry, person. I will call you Terry. I will call you Terry because I don't even know if you're male or female or what your handle was or anything. Thank you for the question, Terry. Yes. I do have a new computer. I have not tried Nier yet. I did install it, but E3's happening and a couple of games are coming out that I've got to check out. But we're coming up on summer, and summer is the dead zone for game releases. So if all goes well, I think I'm going to get Nier another go sometime this summer because I really liked it. I really liked it. I was charmed by the art style and the entire feel of the world. I thought the story was a tonal mess, but it's a tonal mess in the way you completely expect from Japanese properties. Like,
Right.
right, like super deadly serious story moments and then wacky, like pseudo slapstick kind of stuff. Final
Yeah,
Fantasy
that no one seems to
X2,
notice.
right. X2 is kind of the example of that for me, with where I started up the game. Like, you end Final Fantasy X on this horrible, gut-wrenching note where the main character, spoiler, fades out of existence and his entire world falls apart. But by doing so, they've ended this curse that's torn this world apart for 1,000 years. And and Yuna says goodbye to this man that she loves. And it's this really just heart-wrenching moment. And then you start up the sequel, and there's the characters from the first game in a pop concert, and they're all singing and dancing as on the stage as performers. Right? You're like, huh. You know, I'll bet they're not going to do this with Last of Us. So that was really something. So anyway, Japanese games do that often, and you just have to roll with it. And so I really want to analyze this game, but it's one of those games that you have to play through over and over and over again, because every playthrough, you see the entire story from the perspective of a different character. And then you have to put it all together in your mind.
Hmm.
So, it's sounds a lot cool. to take in. Yeah, it does sound cool. I'm looking forward to doing it, but, you know, that's definitely a summer project.
And hopefully it doesn't crash all the time.
Again, yeah. I mean, I know there are people that ran this game and had no crashing problems, so maybe what this person is suggesting, maybe what Terry suggested is true, that it did not like my particular generation of graphics card, and now I have a very different generation of graphics card. So, fingers crossed.
Yeah. And if people want you to play on the PS4, is that, like, I don't even know how that works.
I'm not going to play it on the PS4. I own it on the PC, and that's where I'd rather play it, because it's a little more convenient to get footage. It's more convenient because it all gets sorted into a nice directory that will be called Nier Automata. Or if I play a game on the PS4, it gets all of my gameplay footage just gets thrown into a directory called PlayStation 4. That's not as useful, because, you know, if you play many games, they all end up mixed together. So when I can, I play on the PC. So that's what I'm going to try and do.
All right.
All right. Can you read the next one?
Yeah, here we go. Dear Injection Molding, how do you feel about skipping cutscenes in games where the story isn't very good? What makes you decide to skip a cutscene? And is it... Man, it's hard to say. Skip a cutscene. And is it a scene-by-scene choice, or do you decide, I don't care anymore. I'm skipping everything. As I've gotten older, I've noticed myself becoming more and more willing to go into skip all the cutscenes, I'm only here for the gameplay mode. I'm not sure if there's a specific thing I'm looking for, but it feels like years of experience have made it easier to recognize whether a game story will be worth my time, and now it only usually takes a few hours before I bail out of game's narrative entirely. 93.
This is a very interesting question for me. The thing is, part of my job is analyzing stories that go wrong. So there's this, you know, there's games with good stories that you don't want to skip. And there's games with horrendously bad stories that it's like, you know, I get in and it's all weird and one character is just explaining their character concept to another. And there's like an opening crawl that's 2 minutes long. And nothing makes any sense, and characters are contradicting themselves and changing personality from scene to scene, and you're like, yeah, I'm gonna get me some content out of this one. yes, I will punish this writer. They're gonna pay my bills this month. But then there's like this dead zone in the middle. A game that's
where it's like
just boring enough to not care about, but not so awful that it's, like, worth analyzing.
Right. So for you, you're trying to figure out, like, is this just marginal? If it's just marginal, then I can safely skip it and no one's going to care.
Right. Which isn't a normal use case. I mean, most people, they just get below the threshold that they care about and then they start skipping the cutscenes. And I've also noticed, once you skip one, that's sort of a... It's like choosing to go Paragon in Mass Effect. Once you make that choice the first time, the optimal thing is to just keep making that same choice. You skip one cutscene, you might as well skip them all.
Yeah.
So
you
once,
already risked
you know,
out on whatever story the designer was trying to convey to you, and at that point it's like, well, yeah, why would I stick around for any of the other ones?
Right. What are you going to, like, get five cutscenes later, try to sit through one, and then, like, oh, it's all these plot holes. None of this was explained to me. And it's like, well, you know, kind of my own fault for skipping those cutscenes. So you lose your ability to connect with the story, and then it's just all gameplay. Most people check out when the story gets below a critical threshold, but I have to stick around for a little while and see if it's bad enough that I can do something with it.
Right. Is this decomposed enough to make fertilizer out of?
Yes. Or do I just need to stick it in the pile and just wait for it?
Compost it?
Yeah. All right. I will take this next one. To Diecast, given your recent foray into graphics technology of ray tracing, I was wondering your thoughts on the other end, the display end. From my perspective, you have from 1999 to around 2015, the highest end of display technology being FHD, that's 1080p, and then along comes 4K, and then before 4K can become standardized, along comes 8K, and from there, who knows, perhaps soon enough we'll see 2KK. I don't even know, could that be a thing? And also you have things like HDR and other bells and whistles. Could we be heading towards some sort of arms race with respect to monitors/TVs? Does the pure pixel count of, say, 8K mean anything for the developer's side? Any additional thoughts/speculation? Yours, JDMM. Thank you for this very interesting question. Yeah. Resolutions went up at a very predictable rate before, and then they plateaued for a long time, and now they're going up again, is how I would sum this up. We hovered at 1080p for... Well, 1080p kind of ruled for almost a decade there.
Yeah. It was really nice for me because, like, I do graphics and stuff, and so it was really easy to just be like, oh, well, I'm just going to render this at 1080p, and then, like, everyone will be happy with that.
Right. Yeah. Oh, it was so nice. And games, oh, it was always so frustrating when you were playing an older game and it would default to, you know, 800 by 600 because it was that old. And so it doesn't fit on your monitor and everything's all squished and you've got to do all this fussing. Or the opposite problem where you weren't quite advanced enough to handle the latest game and it just decides to... I remember... There were several points I had a crappy graphics card and every game just assumed that you want to run the game at your desktop resolution. And I remember Barker's Undying launching, and at the main menu, I was getting a frame every 4 seconds.
What?
Yeah.
I don't think that's your graphics card problem. I think that's maybe a design problem.
Well, the main menu did, I mean, there. This was actually, they didn't know it, but it was a feature because it was saving me from playing this horrendous game. I mean, it's just a terrible, terrible
doing
game.
Doing you a real favor.
The main menu is like this layers of flesh sort of warping around each other. So it is rendering stuff, like multiple transparent, like lattice patterns, but still. A frame every 4 seconds. Come on, what are you doing? It evidently just maxed everything out and went to the highest possible resolution and then trapped me there as I tried to exit. It took me a long time.
Oh, no. I know Jonathan Blow did something with Braid where he, and I think he did the same thing with The Witness, where when it's starting up the program, it'll render like 6 or 10 frames at different resolutions and different graphic settings invisibly, like it doesn't show them to you, just like renders them behind the scenes and doesn't display them,
right?
And then clocks the render time and checks to see which ones it should use, like what settings should do for default so that you get good performance right out of the gate. And I don't know, seems like most people should do that these days. It's not hard.
Yeah, it's a tough problem to solve because you want, finding the optimal settings is really hard because especially like 10 years ago when different graphics cards were really sensitive to certain features, like this one can do this particular feature, but it's really, really painful. And for another graphics card, it's no big deal. So you're like sort of trying to test individual features and that can get really complicated to figure that out.
Yeah, and true.
And you want the game to run as you do not want the, you know, the user to try and play your game at 10 frames a second because that's terrible. Or, you know, accidentally launch them in a mode where they're at 4 frames a second and they can't even use the interface. Yeah, I mean, it was super hard. Like, a frame every 4 seconds, like, you move your mouse and you can't tell how far, and then it just vanishes when you get the next frame, and you're like, then you find the mouse cursor, and then you, oh, I overshot by this huge amount, because I think in Clive Barker's Undying, it sort of pulled that mouse movement and then applied it over the next several seconds. So everything was super amplified. Like it was running the interface in real time, but rendering once every 4 seconds. So it was like, oh, it was so hard to just get in there and click on the quit button. So it was a very terrifying game. Why? I give him credit for that. But anyway, yeah, you don't want to trap the user in a slow interface where they're like, oh, I can't run this game. But you also don't want to just default everything to potato mode, because a lot of people will just leave it at defaults, and then all that hard programming goes to waste as they play the game in this awful looking thing. And they'll upload screenshots and they'll upload to YouTube with the game looking terrible. So that's a hard thing to do. And this is making it harder. Multiple resolutions now. I've got a 2K main display.
Yeah, I recently got a 2K display as well. And before it was just like, well, like 1080p is just kind of what you buy and it's good enough and great.
Yeah.
You know, just get a monitor. And then it's about the black ratio, the black-white ratio, right? Or whatever, that's contrast ratio. And the refresh rate and the flicker and all that stuff. But then just recently with this newest computer, I was like, oh, 8K and it's actually not, or 2K, and it's actually not that expensive. And like, sure, that sounds nice, more resolution. But then Windows is all like, some of your apps may be blurry. It's like, what are you even doing, Windows? What are you even doing?
Right? How is anything blurry on this thing? 2K isn't that impressive for gaming. I mean, it's nice. I fired up Borderlands and I was like, ooh, that's crisp. But it's not like this huge, you know, it's four times the processing power for this extra, like, oh, that's kind of nice. But for reading, it's really good. Oh, it's just so good. You can fit so much more text on the screen and it doesn't get blurry and it looks good. And it's just lovely.
Yeah.
Using my music software, that's got a really complicated interface with lots of tiny print. So using that on a 2K display is really, really good.
Yeah, I've noticed too, using Blender and stuff, when you're doing a lot of detailed work and graphical stuff, it's just that extra resolution, it helps. Everything helps.
Yeah. So I don't know to what degree 2K and 4K, I think 2K is fine. It's tough to make a case for 4K and tough to make a case for 8K. Now that I have 2K, I'm like, oh, I like this. But when I was on 1080p, I wasn't like, boy, I wish I had more resolution.
Yeah, it's not like the difference between 60 hertz and 30 hertz.
Right, and it's not like the jump from 640 by 480 to 800 by 600, which was just so, so wonderful. And it's like you boot up your computer at that 800 by 600 and you're like, ah. Oh, you hate when you get a, you know, install Windows 98 for the first time and it puts it on 640 by 480 and you're like, no, oh, this is so horrible. And then you get it in proper mode. Like, oh, so much better. Yeah. Those jumps were important.
Yeah, for 1080p, you can fit all the information you need on the display just fine. Like 2K, you can fit more information on the screen, but you can't really read it. So you end up making everything bigger and then it's clearer, but, you know, it's not like it's more information anymore. It's just a little bit more crisp. I'd say if I had to go back to 1080p and I could get solid 60 frames or 120 frames a second, I'd prefer that over having a bigger, fancier, higher resolution monitor.
Well, I do like 2K. I would be disappointed if I had to go back to 1080p. I do like how convenient it is and how nice it is to read everything. And a lot of the really complicated software I use just really benefits from 2. But I can't imagine anything that would make me plonk down any money for 4K. And 8K is just ludicrous. Like, how would I even see that improvement?
Right. Well, Seamus, you're an old man. Like, there are some people who are young and can see things still.
That's true. That's true. If you're a sighted individual, maybe the difference between 2K and 8K is more noticeable. But for blind people like me, I'm not seeing the case for it. For developers, the whole jump to 8K is probably... Actually, I was going to say it's a nightmare, but is it? It's not that hard to support extra resolutions. I mean, that's on the user to figure out what runs properly.
Well, textures, you know, right? Like, if you've got a display size and you have to put textures on the screen, you have to figure out how close the player can get to stuff before the textures get blurry. And with a higher resolution, they'll be able to see your texture maps more easily, even from further away. So it does become a problem for, like, texture mapping things and doing materials and doing level of detail and stuff.
The last console generation, where everything was just 1080p the whole time, that was probably really convenient on consoles, where the console just, it's 1080p. You plug it into your 1080p television. Oh, you got a 2K television? Well, too bad. I'm just outputting 1080p. Deal with it.
Default mode, yeah.
Yeah, that was probably really nice. You don't need to worry about changing resolution. You only need to consider one profile. Because, you know, you up the resolution and that eats a bunch of VRAM. And then you have less room for textures. So not only is the user able to perceive blurriness or like pixelated textures more, because, you know, the resolution's sharper, but now you have less memory for your textures, so you can't fit the best textures into memory, and that really sucks, and getting that balance right is probably a pain. So it was really nice.
I wonder if there's a market
for
displays that have a graphics card in them to do automatic up-res, so that you can get 1080p from the console or the computer and then display it at 8K or whatever and have nice display quality.
I think they have to have that these days. I mean, I just think that, you know, your 8K TV has to be able to display 1080p.
Right, but I mean, like, do some processing, like some real-time processing on the image instead of just upscaling it, right? To do some processing to, I don't know, vectorize it or something, and then re-rasterize it at the larger resolution.
That would be an interesting... Obviously, you wouldn't want that in a video game, even if that only took, you know, 5 milliseconds. That's 5 more milliseconds you don't want to add on to your input lag.
Yeah.
If you're watching a movie, who cares? I mean, you know, take 100 milliseconds, who cares? As long as the audio is similarly delayed,
yeah,
you're fine.
Yeah, match it up.
But, yeah, like, you don't want to have some display that takes 16 milliseconds, because processing an 8K image is a big job. That's a lot of pixels. So, if that creates 16 milliseconds of overhead and you happen to be playing a game on Google Stadia and it's streaming 8K resolution to you or, you know, 4K resolution to you, there's just going to be so much input lag and you just don't want to add anything to it.
Man, yeah, how are they going to stream high resolution video? That's a problem itself.
My Netflix still turns into potato vision during peak hours. Like if I watch, you know, middle of the evening when most people are watching their shows, oh, it gets blurry. It goes down to like 720p or whatever.
Is that why you go to bed at 3 in the afternoon and sleep through that right. whole period?
Wait until all the losers get off the internet. Here's a funny thing I've wanted to mention, just having to do with resolution. Years and years ago, probably 10 years ago, I made a video on I made one on Fuel, the game Fuel. And I uploaded it, and at the time, it was in 720p. I know this, I was using Windows Movie Maker. That's what it output all the time, 720p. I just went back and looked at that video recently, and it's at 240p. It looks like absolute garbage. And there's all these comments like, "Pha, the 240p video." And I'm like, at some point in the last decade, YouTube threw away the good version of my video. And now the only version you can watch is 240p. No explanation, no notification, nothing. Why? Why was it downsampled? I've never heard of anybody complaining about this. I haven't noticed this anywhere. But I know for a fact that video was not that not that garbage when I uploaded it. Hmm. So I would love to hear from anybody who knows why this is or has heard of this happening before, because that was super annoying.
Yeah, I imagine they probably do that a lot. You know, low view count, and they're just like, well, no one's watching this. We'll keep it up, but we'll just take away all the high-resolution versions. Yeah.
But, I mean, it had tens of thousands of views. It wasn't like one of these 100-view things.
Now I'm curious about my old videos.
Yeah, check on them. All right.
But not now. We have to finish the show.
Oh, yeah. How about we do another email?
Hi. A little late, but I've just listened to your episode 1 answer. This is Star Wars episode 1, I'm assuming. You didn't mention it, but I wonder if you saw SF Debris series on George Lucas, Hero's Journey, Shadow's Journey, and Hermit Journey. I just found it very interesting how he explained flaws in the prequel trilogy, how some of them were unavoidable. And the story behind original trilogy is really interesting as well. I must say, Chuck made me respect George with this series. Best regards, Deadly Dark.
Speaking of things that YouTube ruined, I used to watch SF Debris all the time. That was like a mainstay of my YouTube diet. But eventually, Universal chased him off of YouTube with just constant copyright claims. And he just had to leave the platform. And it was just... Oh, and he was using... I forget what he switched to some video service that had horrible ad. They had like one ad sponsor, and it would play this ad over and over. So if you're going through a number of videos, you'll see this ad dozens of times. It couldn't be skipped. Sometimes it would get through the ad, and then it wouldn't play the video. So you'd reload the video, and then it would play the ad again, and then it might let you see the video this time. So it was just torture to use. So I just fell out of the habit of watching him. And I don't know, did he make it back onto YouTube? How is he surviving again? I mean, SF Debris is just one of the original, one of the OG, like, plot analysts. He was doing that long-form video essay before so many other people. And I wonder what's become of him.
Yeah, it's not like all the long-form video analyst guys are off YouTube these days. There's a bunch of them. It's more than ever, probably.
Right. I think what in that case, Universal was especially... I think it's Universal? Was just really being assholes about copyright claims and just mass claiming everything with Star Trek in the title. Like, because he would have no audio from the show. He would cut it up. So these were like little 10-second snippets that he was using. There was just no way you could claim this was infringing in a meaningful way. This was absolutely 100% fair use, as any rational person would consider the term. But you know, the platform's automated and the big companies have all the power and screw fair use. So that's what happened to poor Chuck. And the thing is, they were really shooting themselves in the foot, since nothing made me want to watch the original Trek like watching his things. I'm like, I could go for this episode again. And then after they chased them off the platform, I stopped seeing basically what were commercials for Star Trek DVDs.
Right.
So stupid. But hey, we have Star Trek Discovery now, so it's okay.
Yeah, how is that going these days?
It's a trash fire.
Oh.
Yeah, I have not watched his series on episode 1. I don't have anything to add on episode 1 that we didn't already discuss a few weeks ago. Episode 1 does seem to be, for movie buffs, what Mass Effect is for us RPG nerds. It's just this puzzle that just demands that you try to fix it. And it's like a jigsaw where the pieces don't fit together. And so you just...
multiple Disney puzzles all mixed together, missing half of the pieces from all the puzzles.
Right, and you're just trying to fix it. And you just, like, how many people have fixing the original trilogy videos out there? Just, it's just, you can't help it. I want to fix it. It just, it's broken in such this captivating way that it's like when you miss a tooth.
It seems like it must have been intentional.
Right. It's like when one of your tooth, you know, you lose a tooth, right? So it hurts, but then you keep poking the spot with your tongue. And if you could just stop poking it with your tongue, it would stop hurting. But you can't stop. That's what these things are like. So anyway, that's what I think of episode one. It feels like losing a tooth.
Oh, sorry. It feels like you got punched in the mouth, huh?
Yeah, except it costs money, and usually punch in the mouth is free. Dear Diecast, why are people reluctant to use the Epic stores? Steam's features are nice to have, but I can't imagine internet rage about Epic exclusives is just because people really wanted to play, e.g. Phoenix Point with Steam achievements and friends list. I don't know. I don't know about that. I mean, I have games that I enjoy on Epic, and all the time I'm frustrated at the lack of Steam stuff. Like,
yeah. Oh, we just talked about this last week about the, about the support. There isn't any, it doesn't exist.
Right. No support, no cloud saves. It's just, there's every time you think, I just changed computers and I was like fired up the game. And I was like, oh, my saves aren't here because I was sort of expecting this to, I've become accustomed to cloud saves on Steam and I don't have that here. And I don't want to go to my old computer and dig around in the directory and find where it stores the saves and copy them to USB thumbstick and bring them over here. I was like, screw it, I'll start a new game. So those features really do matter. They really will irritate you. It's true, achievements and friends lists aren't a big deal for me. In fact, friends list is a massive downside for me on Steam because I have hundreds and hundreds. Back in the old days of my site, my Steam profile, I like linked to it all the time and just everybody just friended me, you know, just, hey, I like this guy. Maybe I'll want him to invite him to my Left 4 Dead if I find him one short one of these days. But I wound up and I just accepted them all. And then I wound up with hundreds of people on my Steam friends list. And some of them were friends and some of them were strangers. And then everybody changed their names. Like everybody changed their handles in the subsequent years, and now I'm like, is this somebody I know? Am I friends with this person? I don't know. I don't want to unfriend them. But I also don't want to be pestered when I'm gaming, so I'm always logged out of friends list on Steam. So I did that to myself, but friends list is useless for me.
Yeah, I occasionally use it, but it's not very useful for me either because it's like it's one of those things where you only see that someone is on when they don't want to be bothered and are just trying to relax after a hard day of work.
Right.
And so it's like the opposite of a useful notification. It's like the chat program that only notifies you when people don't want to be chatted with.
Right. And by default, Steam, I don't know if it still does this, but while you're playing, it used to be really bad in the old days, like, you know, 2010 or something. I'd be playing a game and I'd forget to sign out a friend. You know, I'd just fire up Steam and I'd forget to sign out a friends list. And, you know, sometimes you can disable that, but then Steam randomly turns it on after an update. So, you know, yeah. Steam updates itself, logs you into friends list. You don't notice, you fire up your game and then you're playing your game and you get a little notification. So-and-so is playing Left 4 Dead. 5 seconds later, Joe Blow is playing, you know, Portal 2. Somebody else is playing another game. And it's just this never ending, like, I don't know who these people are. I don't know what games they're playing. And I don't know why I should care. And why am I seeing all these notifications? And then you're finally, fine, I'll alt tab out of the damn game and turn this stupid thing off. Thanks, Steam. So, yeah, I don't miss friends list on Epic Game Store, but I miss almost everything else.
Yeah, Steam cloud saves are... I used to be like, eh, I don't know. I don't know if that's a big deal or not, but it's a big deal. Like, it's not a trivial problem, and it's solved so well on Steam that you just, like you said, you just don't think about it at all. Like, it doesn't enter your mind that it's a thing that's happening. It's just like, I have access to my save games everywhere, all the time.
The end of this question is, are people just attached to their routines and annoyed by Epic trying to change them? Or do you think Steam provides some specific value that people are fighting to defend? 93. Thanks again, 93. Yes to both. I think a lot of the people, okay, I think there's two things at work here. A lot of the people hating on Epic are like, I will never use the store, which means, you know, they've never used it, so they don't know what it's like. So they're not objecting on the grounds of like, oh, I really miss having these features, or I don't like how it works. They're objecting on a broader, more fundamental level. So some people are like me, they've used Epic and they're annoyed by this shortage of features. But I think other people just don't like being forced. They like, I think Epic would do well to give games away rather than make games exclusive.
As they have been doing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, people don't like feeling like they're being coerced or that they're in the middle of some sort of fight between giants. That's no fun.
Right. But, you know, more carrot, less stick. You know, incentivize instead of forcing.
Yeah. The other thing that's weird about this whole situation is that Steam is, like, Steam is effectively punishing the developers of games for using their platform by charging them a lot of money. Right. But Epic is effectively punishing its customers by creating exclusives so that no one else can get to them, right? So it's like punishing their potential customers. And like, if you're gonna punish someone, you can't do it to your customers. Like, you gotta make your customers happy. And it just seems a little backward on their part.
And I think if they were giving games away for free or advertising, whatever, they could even just offer the games for cheaper. I know Steam has some really crappy terms in their license. When you agree to sell a game on Steam, they don't want you selling it for cheaper elsewhere. I consider that to be very gross anti-competitive behavior. Probably illegal in some jurisdictions, but not others, and I'm not sure where it stands, but it's something that could be worked around. It's definitely something like, oh, you know, you can get Satisfactory on Steam, or you could get Satisfactory Platinum Edition for even cheaper on Epic Games Store. Oh, what's in the Platinum Edition? And it could be something trivial, but hey, it's technically a different, you know, it's a different edition of the game.
Right, a different kind of game.
Yeah. So that Steam can't complain about that. You can definitely work around rule. You can definitely rules lawyer them. And they're so often asleep at the switch, I don't think they would want to chase every indie pulling that stunt. So that would be like, that's a suggestion for one thing they could do. And I would rather just offer the game for cheaper on other platforms, and then people will think they're, you know, Epic's trying to position itself as fighting against the man. We're standing up to that greedy corporation Steam, but from the user's perspective, it feels like a greedy corporation. If you did it the other way, then they would feel like they were joining your cause. Right? Yeah. Oh, Epic Store isn't as good, but I like support. They would treat Epic the way they treat GOG. I never hear anybody hating on GOG.
Yeah, because it's a crappy underdog. They're like, hey, they're struggling to get by and it's difficult, but, you know, they're doing the best they can.
I mean, GOG misses a lot of features, but, I mean, I bought Witcher 3 on GOG just so the developer would get more money, and no regrets there. Cyberpunk, when I buy that thing, I'm definitely going to get it through GOG.
Are you going to be able to play with people who have the Steam version, though?
I don't think it's multiplayer.
No.
But more problematic is that my friends on Steam won't see my Chivos. How will they know how lead I am?
That's terrible.
We need
cross-compatibility Chivos. Steam and Epic, you need to come to the bargaining table, settle your differences, and give us cross-platform, cross-compatibility, multilingual Chivos for everyone.
need to make an open standard for Chivos. All right.
Dear Diecast, there's been a lot of noise from gamers who are discontent with... This is formatted oddly. Hang on a second. I'm going to fix the formatting.
All right. You know what? Go ahead and leave this in the show, Isaac. You know the funny thing about that formatting? The person who sent this email put in hard carriage returns after they typed a certain width of characters. That's why it looked so wrong. So they put in a carriage return and, you know, it looked correct on their screen. And then it comes to our screen and it makes no sense. And it word wraps in a weird place and it looks like free verse poetry.
It was difficult to read.
My first instinct when I see that is delete it. Like, when I see that, like, 90% of the spam on my blog looks like that.
Oh, with, no.
With hard right. character returns.
Yeah, this
returns.
Is spam bot. Yeah.
Right. And so anytime I see text formatted like that, my brain goes, oh, that's spam. And I'm like, wait, no, this is an email. I deliberately pasted this into this document. It's not spam. I read it.
On purpose. Oh, dear. All right, there's been a lot of noise of late from gamers who are discontent with certain decisions that game devs / publishers are making. Notable examples are things like EGS exclusives and EA Maximus of everything. While conventional wisdom holds that companies listen to customers who vote with their wallets, games that are being complained about seem to sell a fair share of copies. Do you guys think that gamers just don't have the discipline to actually follow up with their threats? Keep up the good work. Tim.
So yeah, gamer boycotts, I think famously, don't work. And I don't think it's... people frame it like this, like, oh, gamers say they're not going to buy a game, but then they do. I think it's not that. It's just that those of us who are engaged and reading gaming news, we tend to forget that we're like a tiny percent of all gamers. And the vast majority of gamers don't read gaming sites. And they just, you know, buy a game and play it. The same way that I watch Netflix shows. Just like, oh, this looks good, I'll watch it. Oh, wait, it's crap. Okay, I'll watch something else. Like, that's how most gamers engage with video games. And so, when your hardcore 10% of your audience boycotts you, it doesn't actually hurt that bad.
Right. And maybe the community goes away, because those people are also probably the ones who are contributing to the community and giving it life. But... you might not notice that for this one. You might only notice after a long period of time or over a long series of games. That doesn't have an immediate effect. It doesn't show up in the balance books.
Right. Or it shows up as this tiny little dip. You know, if it does show up at all, it's like it's lost in the noise of the bar graph that you're looking at. Like, that could be anything. That could be re-released too close to another game in the same genre.
Yeah.
Or it could be, 10%, like 10% of your people are hardcore, they don't buy it, but it just so happens you released at just the right moment when there was really nothing else coming out, and so sales are great. And of course, you know, executives will just think, well, obviously I'm a business genius.
Sure.
And so, yeah, the hardcore of us that actually care about stuff are not enough for our boycotts to hurt companies. But, I mean, there's no reason to, like, don't think of it as hurting yourself. I never thought of, like, oh, I'm going to boycott something. I just think, oh, these guys are assholes. I don't want to do business with them anymore. And I'll just, like, not buy a game.
Like, yeah, I don't want to burden myself with having a relationship with this person. Like, it doesn't have to hurt them. It just has to remove me from being hurt myself.
Right. I mean, there are just so many games coming out. It does hurt when the game is just something extra special that you really love. That really does sting. You know, if it's just a genre that you don't get a lot of titles for, and I feel like I don't want to support this company, but if I don't buy this, I'm not going to play one of these games for years.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's interesting, because the two examples here, EGS and EA, both make most of their money selling to people who are not hardcore gamers.
EGS makes most of their money selling to children who are playing Fortnite, and EA makes most of their money selling to sports guys who are playing their sports titles. And then the gamer stuff is just kind of a side business. It's like, well, you know, as long as we have all these studios, we may as well make some games for, like, hardcore gamers, too. But if the hardcore gamers don't like it, they don't even notice because that's not their core market. And I think there are companies who do make games for hardcore gamers, and they don't need to be boycotted because they know where their market is, and they don't mess up, and they don't, you know, offend everyone. Or at least that portion of the market.
Dear Diecast, oh, here somebody is cheating. They've posted multiple questions into the same email. Well, we'll allow it. Since this is the mailbag bonanza or extravaganza or whatever I said we were calling this, blowout, yeah, whatever it is. Okay. First question from this person. Will there ever be another This Dumb Industry column? Initially, you said you would return to it if you found something infuriating, but I haven't seen a post like it since. Yeah, I've got a few This Dumb Industries in the pipe. It's just, I need to feed the escapist column. So This Dumb Industry is kind of saved for stuff that's probably a little too ranty for the escapist. They don't want my crazy tirades, my right. goofy gimmick posts where I just pretend to go insane or whatever. And I haven't had anything really make me that angry lately. Like, there hasn't been anything really, really crazy. But yeah, I consider This Dumb Industry open for, you know, it's still a thing. I still love that for a column title. I wish I'd called Experience Points This Dumb Industry. I think it's a better branding. I love the header image for This Dumb Industry. Like,
that's a really good one.
Yeah, that controller header image. I love that. It makes me happy to put columns in there, but I just haven't had the content for it recently.
Second question. Valve and Blizzard seem to have a similar fall of grace and have a similar lofty background. Is it fair to compare their fall from grace side by side, or are they completely different and just happen to collapse at the same time?
Huh. I think collapse is a bit strong since they're both like really healthy companies, but I know what you mean. They've both had Valve stopped making games entirely, and I think Blizzard has had a dip in quality. Like, their games were a must play for me, and now it's like, that's not bad. To me, they're just another developer.
Yeah, although that was a long time for Valve too. Yeah, you know, it is an interesting parallel.
Both so big. They both had super, you know, everybody's played it, hit games. Yeah. And Valve stopped making them entirely, and Blizzard just kind of gradually, and I can't even point, it wasn't like Mass Effect where I'm like, oh, that was a pretty big dip, or not Mass Effect, BioWare, where you can like point at one point and say, wow, there was a dip in quality here. It just seemed to be a gradual shift in business model or attitude. I'm not sure what it is. I haven't, like, put my finger, like, what is it about Blizzard that makes their stuff just not quite as good? There's nothing, like, offensively bad in any of it. It's just not as magical, not as just, oh, this is such a perfect game. And that's hard
to quantify.
Well,
it seems like both of them have... Like, they started up making high-quality games, and then they both had this large product that kind of turned into a service. Like, World of Warcraft was a product that they sold, but it was essentially a service. And then there's this really long grind of just, like, keeping this thing running and churning, you know, turning the mill. And same thing with Valve. Valve started Steam, and then it just kind of turned into a service. And then, like, well, now it seems like all of their efforts are focused on just keeping Steam... You're keeping Steam running. And so maybe that's the connecting link there is, like, if you've got a great game company, don't turn it into a service company.
Yeah, Epic.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's probably a problem in a lot of businesses. If you get one thing that's suddenly a runaway hit, Even movie directors have this problem. You make one, you know, James Cameron makes Avatar, and he's like, okay, I made that movie. Now I want to go and make other movies because I'm a director and that's what I do. And the studios are like, no, we want you to make us nothing but Avatar movies forever. I mean, you know, we want to turn everything to a franchise and crank it out. And we found something that really works. And we want to just do that one thing as much as possible.
Right. And you can't do that in a creative environment because all your creative people can't stand that. They don't want to keep cranking stuff out. They want to go do something creative.
Right. They would rather try a bold new idea that doesn't quite land than do the same damn idea all over again and sell a bajillion copy. I mean, to them, they get paid the same paycheck at the end of the project. So I'd rather be working on something interesting and exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the job, you know, that is the job satisfaction is, am I enjoying working on something creative and different, or am I working on an assembly line?
Yeah. And it's kind of hard for, well, we're both fairly creative people. And I feel like it's hard for people who aren't very creative to understand that, where they're like, hey, you've got job security, you know, you can keep doing this. You know what you're doing already, so there's no real difficulty and challenge to it. So it's like, you should be happy, right? And for a creative person, it's like, no, that's the opposite of happiness. You know, there's this drive that you need to be doing something that's exercising the whole of your being and expressing something meaningful. And like, yeah, it's not an option to just not be creative. You have to do with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Question three, related to above question, is it possible for a small studio to deliver another brilliant title like Half-Life, or do modern AAA games require such a large crew that a big name title by a new developer like Valve or Remedy, Max Payne, can no longer happen? I have this question too. I have this exact question. I think about this all the time. Because, yeah. You know, a game made by 15 people is fundamentally different than a game made by 80 people. It's just 15 people can put their individual flourishes on the game. And the game made by 80 people maybe has individual flourishes from the top two people, you know. The game designer and the narrative designer, and everything else is just everybody else is working in an assembly line. So
it gets averaged out. Even if they have creative input into the game, it just all gets averaged out to the average of the whole system.
Right. Right. And yeah, any one person's contribution must necessarily be that much smaller. I don't know.
I feel like there's I feel like there's got to be a way to have a high quality experience with the individual touch. It just takes a long time, right? Like you have to wait a number of years between releases to get that experience.
That's what I wonder. Like, my dream would be if somebody's like, Seamus, here's a big pile of money, go make us a AAA game. I would not hire 80 people and try and make a game in 18 months. I would want to hire 20 people and make a game in several years. Like, that's what I would want to do. And graphics are at the point now where if you release a game in 2019 that still has 2015 graphics, nobody's going to notice. Nobody will care. It looks exactly the same. Not exactly the same. There are little touches that we've come along with, that have come along in the last few years, but they are all so, so minor compared to art style. If you've got great artists, you could release a game. Well, Borderlands, classic example. Borderlands 3 and Borderlands 2 look so similar. It's just like, it's the art style is what the game looks like.
Right.
And the real quality of your visuals comes down to how good are your artists. And again, smaller crew is better. The the top five artists you could find are by necessity going to be more skilled than the top 30 artists you can find. Right.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's, I don't know, modern, of course you could define modern AAA game to, in order to make this question yes or no, you know, depending on what you want. But I feel like there's still room to make something really special. And people are coming out with neat games all the time. But the other thing is that back when Half-Life or Max Payne came out, the field of games was much smaller. Like, there weren't as many games coming out all the time, so it was possible to be a smash hit and capture 90% of the market. And right. These days, it's just not possible anymore. There's so many games coming out and so many niches. You can't have a appeals to everyone game. And even then, right, like, there were people who played Half-Life, but there are other people who would have played a new Civilization game or something preferentially if it had come out that year, but it didn't. Whereas nowadays, you can find a city building game that's going to come out every 16 months, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds totally reasonable.
Or every month, or even.
Right. All right.
Number four. A bit longer question. A while ago, under an Andromeda retrospective post, I joked about how if you would be in the writer's chair, you would also have to write romance. Yes. To which you replied that you wouldn't be too happy about that. A nice discussion happened to that, and overall, it seemed people were confused, for a lack of a better word, about romance in video games. Which leads me to the question, can you write good optional romance in a video game? Most optional romance, romance or no central part of the plot, seems mostly about talk to the girl you like X times, do X, Y stuff, and get the girl. This seems stupid, but at the other hand, most of the often the MC is a capable, attractive, and interesting character, so he, she seems to tick most of the boxes for a romantic partner. So really, how can you write a romance in a story if it's not integral to the story? All of these questions, anon.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I've been thinking about romance. I got needled by a couple of people in my most recent book. You know, why are you so afraid to write romance, Seamus?
And oh, really?
Okay. My mom was one of them. But, but you know, people, in fact, all of the people that commented on the why couldn't you do more with the romance, all of them were females. But it's mostly like I'm afraid, like, when romance is bad, it's really, really bad. And I'm afraid of messing it up. I'm confident on my world building. My dialogue's okay. I can come up with a good structure, a good plot structure. But boy, I don't want to ruin that with just this cringe-inducing romance.
Yeah.
And
I, for my part, in your most recent book, I found the romantic relationship that was there to be very evocative. Like, for me, that mirrored a lot of my experiences, kind of feeling out, like, who is this person and do they care about me or not, and getting it wrong, and kind of the uneasy tension without ever coming to a really satisfying closure. And so, like, that was good for me. So maybe you just are writing romance for men instead of for women.
It's strong enough for a man, but no, it's strong enough for, no.
But optional, yeah, it does tend to grab, doesn't it? Like, if you do it well, it tends to kind of grab the whole story.
Right. Yeah, that sort of optional romance. Usually romance needs to, the worst romances in movies are the hero saves the world, and in the process, this girl comes to love him because he's so heroic. And I don't want to say that's bad, but that's really, really overdone. Like, that has been done, and it is so hard to make that interesting these days. And so you kind of need, instead of he has to earn her approval and therefore he gets the girl at the end, which is a very, like, okay, that plays really well with your young male demographic. But if you're trying to make a movie with kind of attaching more broad themes that kind of resonate with everyone, then you need both of the characters, not just like she's this goal for him to attain. They both need to have some kind of personality flaws, hang-ups. You can see why they want to be together. You can see the force that's keeping them apart, and they overcome that. And that's more complicated. That is definitely harder. And it's going to eat some screen time. And when you do it right, it's like, wow, that's kind of woven into the fabric of the story here. Like, you can't just make it optional.
Right. Well, and that's the whole point, is like, if you succeed, the idea is, if you succeed as a human being, then other human beings will find you attractive and you will be able to attract a mate. And, like, that's a very old story.
Right? Like, just as an example, in The Empire Strikes Back, that the romance between Han and Leia is, I think, really powerful. And it becomes an incredibly powerful element of the plot at the end when they make a Han-sickle. And,
right,
like, that moment works because of the dialogue between those two people, and because that romance has been established in the mind of the audience. And if you took that out, it would be a lesser movie. It's not like he got the girl because he was so heroic. It's like these two people were having romantic tension and were attracted to each other, and because of their background, they were having trouble making it work, and they couldn't really sort it out until it was too late. And that's just powerful drama.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because I feel like we've all been there to some degree or other, right? Where it's like, man, I feel like this could have been really good and it didn't turn out. And you know, that's a real story. But like you say, that grabs the whole story, and it kind of encapsulates the whole thing. And so you can't just be like, well, you know, you could play through The Empire Strikes Back with Han just being a jerk and no one caring about him. It's like, well, then why would we care about the ending where, like, he's suddenly taken away from everyone? Like, no one's going to be sad about that.
Right. Or where he could romance, you know, R2-D2 or something. And it's like, well, you know, it's like, this is a different kind of story now.
Right. And well, either way, romance becomes central, right? Like, it becomes right. The driving factor of that whole story. So I think my answer to the question is, if you have romance in a story, you're going to have to take it seriously to do it well. And if you take it seriously, it's going to have to be central to the story.
You have this problem in a game where I can watch two other people fall in love, come together as a couple. It feels a little weird if I'm participating in that. Like, if the game is saying, you're romancing this person now. And I'm like, well, I kind of uncomfortable with this. Okay, she's pretty, but I just don't want to be in a relationship with Morrigan here. She's really not my type.
Right. Yeah. In a movie, really, you can say these two characters do well together. And it's like, okay, I'll buy that premise. But in a game, it's like, you do well with this other character. And it's like, hey, hang on. You don't know me. You, right. Like, I'm already committed in real life or whatever, right?
Right, exactly. Or this person is very much not my type, and actually I wish you'd let me throw them out of the party. And right. Oops, I select the wrong thing, and
they have to be
flirting.
Optional.
Yeah,
they right. Have to be optional. Like, wait, what's going on?
But then if you make that optional, then you immediately get the, hey, how come straight guys can romance a character and nobody else can? Okay, well, we'll put in more options. Okay, well, how come straight men and, okay, well, we should have support for gay character, but all of a sudden now, and it's not like any of those things are bad things to have, but it suddenly becomes this intractable problem where everybody in the crew is romanceable, and so all of their stories are tacked on and superfluous, and then suddenly the romance is an end in and of itself. Instead of being woven into the main story, it's just like, oh, you and this person are a couple now. It will never come up again. It will never be part of the story. But You know, the game recognizes...
Whereas, like, if you've ever been on a spaceship, that's all anyone ever talks about is who's with who. So, like, right. It's not even realistic at all.
Right. And in a video game, it's like, okay, you are a couple now. Here's a Chivo. It's like, this isn't really that satisfying.
Yeah. You don't get to build a life together. You don't get to, like, none of that stuff happens unless it's central to the story, and then you don't have the options, right? So, it really is a difficult conundrum.
Right. And the more, I mean, I used to really like all the optional flirt with the character, I kind of thought the thing with Bastila was a little fun in KOTOR, but the more I think about it, the more I think, you know what, you guys are having enough trouble writing a coherent plot these days. Just focus on your main plot. Why don't you take a break
from the romance for now?
Right. Why don't you just focus on your main thing? Leave the dating to the Japanese schoolgirl dating sims.
And the match 3 games, apparently.
Yes, that's a really strong in Honey Pop romance. And the romantic attraction from people falling in love is definitely a very important element in that game.
It couldn't have been optional. Integral. It had to be central to the story.
Right. How you just fall in love with these never-ending parade of hot girls and consummate it as soon as possible. You just have a lot of love to give, apparently.
Oh, dear.
I'm just bursting with love. So, that's it. We conquered the mailbag.
It was the final question. It was a four-part boss. We've conquered its final form.
I didn't get any good drops. No legendaries.
What? You're just saving it for yourself. You don't want to tell me about it.
All right, everybody. That's the show. Thank you for listening. If you want to send us questions, because now the mailbag's empty, if you want to send us your questions and have us attempt to answer them, the email is diecast@shimsyoung.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. Say goodbye, Paul.
Goodbye. Okay, so do I have to wash the mailbag now before we put any new mailbags in? Because it seems like they're getting a little smelly, and I don't know. Maybe we should let it air out for a bit.
Oh, you're supposed to wash that thing? Oops.